We are not, you say, experts in this matter of marriage. You don't claim to be. Many of you, you could be the ones who are up here sharing this just as well as we could do. We've had no special schooling in this area. We've had the School of Experience. I've been married now for a little over 21 years and have shared something of the joys and the anguish of that kind of a intimate relationship. And we tried to put some of that in the book, and we'd like to try to share a little bit of it with you tonight. One of the things that we'd like to try to do, we don't try to preach any sermon here or anything, but we have come to believe that it's exceedingly important that all areas of our life be lived in the context of grace. And there is great stress on grace around Holden Village, we have discovered since we arrived here for the first time last Sunday. So we haven't been here as long as most of you, a little longer than a few of you. We have just arrived today or yesterday. But we think that's very, very important, and there are many, many aspects. We could, I'm sure, just have hours and hours of discussion. We thought tonight we'd try to get our heads together and prepare some things, and we're prepared to share a few thoughts, to sort of touch base, so to speak, on four different bases. If we get that far, I've learned in the days, these few days I've been here, that you don't always get through your notes around Holden Village, and that's perfectly all right. But we thought we might say a little bit about married life in the context of grace in terms of the expectations that we bring to marriage and have in marriage, the communication that's involved in marriage, the matter of decision-making, which is an extremely significant and I think for many people controversial issue these days in terms of marriage, and then if we get that far, perhaps a little bit on the sexual relationship, again in the context of grace. I think that's the whole matter of grace and a couple's relating to each other sexually is an exceedingly important matter. And anyway, those are some of the things that we have in mind, and you may have some things in mind, but we'll kind of take it from there.
I think to start things off, I'd like to talk a little bit about expectations that people have when they get married. And I think back, I can even quote a saint of, in a sense, here for Holden, that when I attended St. Olaf College, I had Howard Hong as one of my professors, and I stood in great awe of Howard Hong. And after I graduated, I was working in New York City, and who should walk into my office one day but Howard Hong? And of course, you know, I was just like this to think that he would stop and see me. And he took me out for lunch that day, and instead of just having coffee, we had liverwurst on rye with a kosher pickle. And in between the conversation of finding out what had happened to each of us since we had last seen each other, Dr. Hong got around the subject of Lowell and me being married in the near future. And he asked me, you know, what were my plans or our plans? And I was going on and on as to, you know, what it was going to be a preacher's wife and how I was going to do this and how Lowell was going to, you know, everything that I did was in context of what Lowell was doing, actually. And Howard Hong looked at me and he says, but Carol, he says, what about you? What about Carol? You're not going to become Lowell and Carol as if you're one person. You are still Carol. And, you know, that really caught me up short. And I suppose one wouldn't have to be a philosopher like Howard Hong to have thought of that. I probably should have thought of that myself. But I think sometimes, I think I was a product, I suppose, of society at that time. I mean, at that time, women were to think of themselves as helping their husbands. You were to be the helpmeet. You were to enable them to do everything. And this is just what I thought that I was going to do. And I've thanked Dr. Hong many times for having called me to think about what I should expect of marriage. And that I think as we think about marriage, we think of ourselves as two people coming into a very special relationship, but that we are still two people. That, you know, many times we've been at weddings, and I don't think, and I know that Lowell has not had any of these, but where you have these candles.
Not lately, anyway.
And they will take, you know, and light one candle from two. You know, there'll be three candles, and they'll take the two candles, and they'll light the one, and then they'll blow out the two. As if in marriage, when you become one, that that's the end of the two of you. And I think that's really bad. You should light that candle, but there should still be three candles. That in marriage, it is the relationship of two persons together. It is not, you know, the melding of the two into one. Much like, you know, we used to talk when I was younger about the melting pot in the United States. Now they don't talk about the melting pot, they talk about salad bowl, you know, where everybody keeps their distinct thing. And I think that's the same way in marriage, that we each bring ourselves, and that it's very important. And I think some of the expectations that we have in marriage depend on how we look at this marriage in terms of two persons. And I think sometimes we've talked about some people don't have very high expectations, and they're ready to run off and get a divorce as soon as things don't go right. And they're not too realistic about it. But I think if we're realistic, we can see that when two persons become married, that, you know, there will be times when you will have disappointments, there will be problems. Some people have said, you know, problems come from being single, and other people say, well, the problems come from being married. And I think most of us will say the problems come from being human. There are problems in life, no matter what your married state is. And I think it's important for us to be realistic, and that we expect that there will be problems, that there will be areas that we will have to work out together. But in this whole graceful existence, that there will be ways in which we can do this. And I think one of the ways that we anticipate marriage is not to anticipate, you know, the everything with rose-colored glasses, but to anticipate that in love and in grace, we as two committed individuals will be able to work that out. And to do that, it depends a great deal on how well we communicate with each other.
We've tried to illustrate some of these things by telling a few stories and so on in our little book, and on the assumption that most of you haven't read that, we may share a few of those again. And I think of a friend who years ago said to me, as we were talking about some of these things, said, it's terrible to be married. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he went on to tell about, well, how it's terrible to be married, and the responsibilities you have, and all of the difficulties, and the sickness, and all these things that happen. And then he went on to say, it's also wonderful to be married. It's the most meaningful and wonderful relationship in my life. And we've often thought and talked about that. It's terrible and wonderful to be single. It's terrible and wonderful to be married. It's terrible and wonderful to be alive in this world. Mm-hmm. And that in terms of expectations, that it's pretty important to keep that in mind. I remember many years ago, I could even tell you when it was. It was in 1954 when my uncle and his bride celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary. I can remember that date because he told us that he and his bride had gone to the St. Louis World's Fair in 1904 on their honeymoon trip. That's meet me in St. Louis, Louis, and all of that. And he gave a little talk in the church basement on the occasion of that wedding anniversary. And he told a little story, which it was likely an old joke then, but I think still has meaning today. He said that in all of those 50 years of marriage, he and his wife had never thought of separation or divorce. But they had thought of murder on quite a few occasions. And that. In our 21 years of marriage, we have had some of those days too. And we think it's very important for a couple to be realistic about that. And I regularly these days in wedding sermons, they're different kind of things, but I often predict to couples that they're going to have days when they think of murder, and that when that happens, it does not mean that they have a bad marriage. It can mean they have an intimate marriage, a marriage in which they really have some sharing in depth. And that takes us into, just to say a little bit, again, touch that base of expectation, and we like to touch the base of communication and of talking with each other. And I think that in the whole matter of communication, if we're going to have openness and sharing, it isn't possible for us only to share the happy stuff, the things that make us glad and so on. If we really have intimacy, we have sharing of the stuff that isn't so happy either. Jess Lehrer, in his little book, I Ain't Much Baby, But I'm All I've Got, says that to love is to share what is in our deepest heart. And if we know ourselves and know others, we know that what is in our deepest heart is a great mixture of all kinds of stuff. Very beautiful stuff. God has created us in his image, and that is there. We have love and goodness and kindness and so on, but a lot of things on the other side as well. And again, we think of a lot of experiences and discussion with people. I was involved for 5 years in a little counseling center as a volunteer counselor, and I remember one time that talking with, I think a lot of things, several stories I could tell along these lines, but I remember a woman who came to see me one time, and she began by telling about what a wonderful person her husband was. That he was kind, and he was loving, and he was faithful, and he didn't get drunk, and he was great with the children, and just went on and on and on. This was a little different. I wonder, where is this going, you know? And then she said, there's just one little thing. He doesn't talk to me. That seems to me many times as I go to the doctor and saying, you know, your blood pressure is perfect, and this is great, and everything's great, that just there's this there's a little malignancy here that we have to deal with. And as we visited and talked about these things, and later visited with her and her husband together, they're wonderful people, and he was, so many of us men are perhaps a bit reluctant about talking about something. They did talk. I mean, they wasn't, you know, never talks to me. He did talk, you know, pass the potatoes, and shall we go to the movies, or... You know, how are things going? Should we go shopping? All this kind of stuff. But he did not share what is in his deepest heart. And that's what she was really looking for. And that's often very difficult. Many times in these counseling things, and I'm not an expert counselor either. Some of you know more about that than I begin to know, I'm sure. But we try some things. We suggest to people sometimes to sit down and write a letter to each other. We suggest some of these games. We've suggested some of these in the book. The Honey, I Wish game. All you could take the honey eye, all kinds of things that you could list, many different kind of things. Honey, I'm glad. Honey, I'm grateful. All kinds of things. And then complete the sentence, and each one of you do about 10 of those, and then sit down and talk about it and share it together. And we try in that to get people somewhere to enable us more and more, and all of this hopefully in the context of grace, to share what is in our deepest heart. And I think there's some amazing things that happen when we begin to do that. I think of another occasion in that counseling center of a meeting with a couple, and this woman was just enraged at her husband. And as we were sitting there talking about things, she was talking to him, and she just berated him up and down and chewed him out something fierce. And I'm sitting there taking all this in, and I don't, I got to fly by the seat of your pants in these situations, don't know exactly what to say. And after she had a little lull in that business, I just asked her, you know, what are you trying to tell him? And just kind of miraculously, the whole mood of the situation changed, and she began to cry. And through her tears, she said, I just wish that once in his life he'd take me in his arms and tell me that he loves me. Now, I'm not so sure he was getting that message through all of that. But that in back of that frustration and anger and all of that was a tremendous yearning and a cry for love. And, you know, we can think about it. You say, well, why didn't she just go ahead and tell him? But we know if we think about that, we know that kind of ruined it. You know, he'd come home from work and she'd give her a great big hug and she'd think, you're just doing that because I asked you to do it. And that somehow we need in all of these things to try to have some continuous communication, so it doesn't have to get to that kind of a crisis. I think maybe you could, I don't know, we haven't divided us up very much. I'm going to say a little bit more about sharing of hostile feeling. Maybe you could talk about that.
You can go. Well, it's like this. No, I think the other day I sat in on Kathy's discussion.
I did this morning on her discussion. That's very much along these
and how lines. To deal with anger. And this is something that I think I'm an elementary school librarian, and in Minnesota now you have to have human relations to be recertified. So I've had quite a few human relations courses. And it really is true that sometimes these courses can be very helpful, despite what teachers think, you know, when you have to take them. And I think one thing that really I think has been helpful to me is this whole idea of when we are angry to realize that we're angry because of something, and that something is not always your husband that makes you angry per se.
Sometimes.
It might be something he does, but it isn't just him. The same thing with our children, that anger is something that is a secondary, it's a response to something. And that if we can somehow share with another person what is making us angry. I have a tendency to be rather quick to express my anger. That is something that I have to be a little bit concerned about. I'm married to this good guy.
I was going to confess that I'm a nice guy who never gets angry.
But so he's eating Maalox all the time.
Yeah. Right. And I'm the one who may brood on things for 3 days, and she's over it in 10 minutes.
But I think in this is something that we have, you know, have come to learn too together, is that it helped if, you know, I come home from school, and I leave before he does in the morning. And if I come home from school and those breakfast dishes are still sitting on the table, and, you know, they're not in the dishwasher and the place is a mess, you know, I just get a bit angry. And usually he's not there, but the children are, and I'll right away start in saying, you know, why didn't you pick up this mess? Well, then I kind of remember what I learned in my class, and I've learned to identify and to share with my children as well as my husband how I feel by telling them what makes me angry. When I come home from school in the afternoon and see the dishes still sitting on the table from breakfast, and I think that now I've got to do that while I'm supposedly thinking about supper, that makes me feel really put upon and frustrated, and then that makes me angry. Well, if I can share that feeling, it's much more apt to resolve some of this situation that produces the anger than if I just come in and say, boy, you kids make me mad. Because right away, the minute we do that, whether it's with our husband, our wife, our children, you know, there's confrontation and there's defensiveness.
Even saying, you kids make me mad, is not anywhere near as bad as saying, you kids are irresponsible and selfish and dumb and stupid and all kinds of other things.
I think we tend, if we can keep from labeling each other and instead try to get at some of these things, that helps. And that's a communication skill. And I think, you know, for all that people say these things are just techniques, I don't think they're techniques. I think there are ways in which we can learn to be kind to each other or be good to each other. I think this is one thing that has, I think, been a helpful thing in our relationship. And I think it does work. And I think it does not mean that we don't ever get angry. It means that when we are angry, we take responsibility for our anger and try to relate to our mate and try to resolve the things that cause the anger.
I think on this, as we're sharing something of our own personal experience, that I think it has taken me a long time, and I'm not sure that I've gotten too far on the road yet. I mentioned this nice guy business. I think this is something that some of us have to confess. It's taken me a long time just to be able to say in some situations that what you did does make me angry. I feel put down, or I feel hurt, or to confess my own feeling. Seems to me a confession is generally much safer than attacking somebody. And if we can learn to confess instead of to attack, that's a very significant thing.
And I think at this point too, I think in our culture, it has been very difficult for men, to, especially men, to confess how they feel. Most men don't want to say, I feel put down when you do something like that or when that happens. Because, you know, they have to be the macho male all the time, and it's the woman that's supposed to have all this feeling business. And I think this comes with this whole business of the integrity of the person, that each person has their personhood, and that is what we want to share with each other.
Carol mentioned that she can easily be quick in the expression of anger and hostility. I would not disagree with that in public or private, but I would say at the same time she is equally quick in expressing her appreciation, her affection, and everything else along that side, and so I don't think I'd care to trade, even after 21 years. I think that may be a little illustration about how you just can't have it only one way. I think on this anger business, One of my favorite verses in the New Testament is Ephesians 4:26. Be angry, but do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. Now, that's interesting. Be angry, the New Testament says. I think some of us need to take a look at that, but do not sin. And we could discuss that. We're just going to touch some bases here, so I better not go on and elaborate too long on all that. But we've thought sometimes that, you've heard these things, what are the most important words in marriage and so on. And as we've talked about this and tried to come to some conclusions on it, we are so far pretty well convinced that the three most important words in marriage are I love you, and the next three most important words in marriage are thank you, honey, and the third most important group of three words in marriage is I'm sorry, honey. And that this matter of confessing and sharing our own failures, again, is part of communication. I told a little story this morning in this session with Kathy and the group on communication there, that when I was a kid, 10, 12 years old, my dad and I, we lived on a farm, we're out working on putting up a fence together, and I must have done something that was rather foolish, because he got angry, and he said to me, don't be so damn stupid. And that was not his normal way of conversation. But I must have really gotten to him, or he may have been having a bad day. And several hours later, he came back to me and he said, I want to ask you to forgive me for that. I think he was more concerned about having called me stupid than having used the word damn, but maybe they both two went together. Didn't either one? But he you are not stupid. I should not talk to you that way. It was really a very emotional experience for a guy who was not very emotional, rather a stoic Scandinavian farmer. And that has made a tremendous impression upon me. And I've often thought of how that really is an example of what it is to be a Christian example. Christian example is to acknowledge our own faults and failures. And I think in marriage, I don't know that, I don't mean to just kind of parrot these things, but that I'm sorry, honey, is a tremendously important part of communication. I think that Beauvais, in that little handbook on marriage, and Carol Hinderly has a tape over there, they're reviewing that book, and I've handed out dozens of copies of that book. It's a very excellent book in many, many ways. That I think it's in there somewhere that he says that when a couple have an argument, and each one thinks that he or she's 100% right and the other one's 100% wrong, if one of them has the honesty to say to the other, you know, honey, I think maybe I'm 2% wrong. I was too hasty. I shouldn't talk to you that way. He says the argument's often 100% over. But instead of people knocking their heads together, you've got communication again. And anyway, that whole communication thing is tremendously important. Let's just test, we got to watch our time here, that I want to say a little bit about decision-making. And since I'm talking, I think I'll quit and see if Carol has something to say about that.
Oh, gee. Well, I think in decision-making, so many of us, I suppose we take our cues from the Apostle Paul. I mean, it's in the marriage service itself about the man being the head of the house, and that we are to submit ourselves, and that in a sense it has always been, so to speak, in most, I suppose, in many families, that the husband is the decision maker. There might be some discussion, but we have kind of put the responsibility for decisions on his shoulders. And I think kind of speaking out of experience and from some of the discussions that we've had, I know just about a year ago I was visiting with a group of young women, and we were talking about this whole women's issue, which is kind of fits in here, I think, on this decision making. And some of these young married women were saying, well, that's what we do at our house. My husband makes all the decisions, and that's the way we want it. And there was a very really fine young woman sitting there, and she hadn't said very much before this time. And she said, you know what? She says, I just couldn't do that. And she said, it's not because I don't think my husband, you know, is a fine man, but she said, you know, we have both been created in the image of God, that God has created both of us with an intelligence, and both of us have different gifts, and we have, you know, we are both persons of worth. And she said, I think for me to say, that my husband has the final decision in all matters would be to deny my personhood in Christ. And you know, I just sat there, and this woman, I'm sure, was half my age saying this, and I thought, boy, that, and I think that says
it's
something.
A girl.
Well, yeah, girl. But I think in this whole business of decision making, you know, it's been acceptable to have this man as the head of the house thing. If you have the woman as the head of the house, you know, then you've got all of this Dagwood Blondie business. You have this whole idea that the man is henpecked. And we all know of many families where, you know, outwardly the man has the right, has the final say, but everybody knows the woman is the one that really wields the power. There have been all of these jokes and all of this through the ages. And I think if we could somehow or other in our decision making look upon the two persons as solving some of these problems and making these decisions together, that we don't necessarily have to say that the man has the final authority. Somebody says, well, we discuss it, but if we can't agree on something, then he decides. Well, that's, you've given up before you've even started if you do that.
We think on this head and heart business, Beauvais talks about that, and the husband is the head of the house, the wife is the heart of the house, and that's a beautiful imagery. And I think in many ways the family that I came from was a family like that, and there are many wonderful families that operate that way. And, you know, praise God for all joy and beauty that comes out of that. But at the same time, we certainly, I don't think we live that way, and we do not advocate that. I think the functions of head and heart should be shared. That women as well as men have brains, and in many cases more brains than men. And men have hearts, in the meaning of that emotional sense of that word. And that these are to be shared. It's not just one for the other. And there are all kinds of, we can discuss, well, how do you make decisions then? And there are many, many different things that go into that. There are many couples who would say, well, we decide what areas we're going to decide. That in these areas, the husband makes a decision. In these areas, the wife makes a decision. And I'm sure that in all kinds of ways, in every marriage, there's a written or unwritten contract that happens. I think a lot of good can come out of that. That can become a kind of a joke, too, that it's like the old story you've all heard about, you know, the husband says, I decide the big things and my wife decides the little things. I mean, she decides how we spend the money, where we live, etc., and I decide what the UN should do and what should be the American foreign policy related to Lebanon and, you know, those are the big issues. But, or it gets to be maybe on the other hand that the wife can decide to pick the wallpaper and he can decide to buy the car or something. Anyway, beyond all of that, what we try to live and try to advocate is that in a relationship like marriage, as well as in all other kind of ways, marriage or the church council or anyway, that we should think not in terms of who's right, but in terms of what's right. What is the right thing to do in this situation? Not just whose idea is it? And if the husband has a better idea or the wife has a better idea, praise the Lord, let's try to go with the best idea. Now, I know there's nothing automatic about this, and you get into all kinds of hassles and difficulties, and, you know, it doesn't solve everything, but it seems to me that it's very, it seems to us, I would say, that it makes a different atmosphere in the whole relationship if you have that kind of a sharing together, and that, you know, we could go on, we could maybe quit talking about that and go on to some other things, and we can save some things, but we can get into discussion. I'm sure that whole area of decision-making might be one of those. Just to touch one other base quickly, and then we'll open this thing up, because it's about half our time is nearly gone now. That just a word, we've talked about the matter of expectations and communication, a little bit on decision-making. Just a brief word on the whole matter of grace and the sexual relationship. That we begin with the assumption that sexuality is a gift of grace. We're talking a lot about these days, and Carol Hinderling and others are about gifts, the whole giftness of life. That the sexuality is a gift to us. And it's a gift not just for the creation of children. Maybe not even primarily for the creation of children. Not even only primarily for expression of love, but also for our joy. And that with that kind of an approach, I think that it puts a lot of things into context. Responsible family planning in that context is not a sin that we are to confess, but a gift for which we thank God. Many, many times visiting with couples planning marriage and so on, made comments that when you thank God for the sunshine and the rain and the Wheaties for breakfast and all of that, thank Him for safe and healthy methods of birth control too. They also are His gift. And there are many other things that we could say about that. We touch upon some of these specific things in the book. One that related to the whole matter of sexuality and sexual relationship, that the whole context of grace is completely contrary to the whole performance kind of concern that seems to be so much a part of the world today. And that I think often, many, many times, sitting with couples counseling about these matters, that it just seems so obvious that people are trying too hard. They're living by their own good works, put in theological terms, that they're trying to achieve some great sexual experience or whatnot. And I think that's often self-defeating. We're talking in another little group this afternoon about there are many things we don't do by trying to do them. They're living by their own good works, put in theological terms, that they're trying to achieve some great sexual experience or whatnot. And I think that's often self-defeating. We're talking in another little group this afternoon about there are many things we don't do by trying to do them. You don't go to sleep by trying to go to sleep. The harder you try to go to sleep, the worse it is. I talked with a counselor the other day who told me that he's counseling with a 10-year-old boy who couldn't go to sleep. And what his treatment, if you want to call it that, for this young boy was to tell him, I want you to stay awake every night until 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'm going to give you 50 cents for every night the next week you stay awake. And he said, the kid came in so sheepishly the next week, and he said, I said, how much do I owe you? Getting out his billfold. You don't owe me anything. He said, I thought sometimes in counseling with people who are all concerned that they're not getting turned on and aroused and all that, then instead of trying to get aroused, you ought to try not to get aroused. No matter what she does, don't let anything happen. And I think that's part of it, is removing the demands. We don't live under demand. We live under grace. Nothing has to happen. You can be good to each other. You don't have to even have sexual relations, as Masters and Johnson and their therapy, if you've been into that. And it's just amazing what kind of things begin to happen when the atmosphere of grace pervades the whole area of a couple's sexual relationship. Another thing in connection with that too, and maybe I'll quit and Carol can say anything on this or open for discussion, that on the whole performance thing, I think it's very, very important for couples to realize that the experience of sexual relations is not always the same. And we use what maybe kind of a corny illustration, or I don't know what kind of illustration it is, in a little book that having sexual relations is sometimes like going to a gourmet restaurant for a 7-course candlelight dinner. And other times it's like going to McDonald's for a hamburger. Mm-hmm. And that's just fine. What's wrong with that? I mean, a 7-course candlelight dinner, that's magnificent. It isn't so bad to stop at McDonald's once in a while either. And I think, again, in terms of the whole context of grace, it just changes the whole atmosphere of a relationship in the sexual area, as well as in all other areas too. Well, any footnotes to that? Pass and open for.
Yeah, I think we should really open it up. I'm sure you have comments or questions or things that you would like to discuss, and we would like to discuss those with you.
When you were talking about anger, you said you were trying to think of ways that you could work with it and express it well. In other words, putting kind of, not saying that you were doing this, but I think everybody says and tends to think that anger is always negative and it's something that really shouldn't be there. But you know, I think, you know, while you try to express it, it's also a good thing. You know, I mean, it's certainly another area of knowing another person, and just a whole other area in itself, you know, of sharing and opening up and knowing another person.
It's really a sign of life.
Yeah.
If you're not angry, I think people who don't feel anger or don't feel happiness or whatever, that's more a sign that something's wrong, perhaps.
I think, too, it's just an absolute, to me at least, fascinating subject or area, and the ways we have of expressing anger. And we often sit with couples, talk about these things before they get married, to say, what are the ways that your parents have expressed their hostile feelings? But we often catch that, even if we don't like it. We repeat in our own lives the patterns of our parental families, even when we are disgusted with it. And you can think of them as well as I can, all kinds of examples of the silent treatment people and the screaming people and the acting out, slam the door people, and, you know, just all kinds of things. And I think it's really a difficult adjustment sometimes if one person in a marriage comes from, say, a silent treatment family, and the other person comes from a shout and scream and yell family. That I think of a visiting with a couple some years ago about along these lines of a woman who said that she just was the first year of her marriage. Well, her husband, he just blow his stack, and he was the one who was, you know, more expressive, and she was the one who never said anything. She'd never seen her parents argue, she said. It was just, you know, she'd never, never say that. And after a year or two of marriage, she made the statement, his way of doing it was healthier than mine. And maybe his wasn't altogether healthy either. I mean, none of us have, anything we do is perfect. It's all unhealthy.
I should say that sometimes communication and opening up to someone, whether it's your marriage partner or a social person, really takes a risk. You have to really get outside of yourself and really risk opening up and risk that someone's going to accept you as you are. And I think in a marriage, when both people are going to look at something, you know, that's really a risk.
It is risky, and I think sometimes when you get into counseling and so on too, things may get worse before they get better. You may have to really face the fact that there are all kinds of things that are being covered up and so on. Hopefully that through this you can come to a new depth of intimacy and understanding. And it's scary to share what is in our deepest heart. And also in communication, when, you know, a situation like this woman, for example, who said, he never talks to me, I think it's very important in a situation like that to say, why doesn't he talk to you? What are you doing that makes it difficult? Maybe every time he tries to say something, you put him down. Or maybe it's because he's bringing into the marriage some pattern out of his background that you just don't share those things with anybody.
I think that that's something that develops after you're in marriage. I mean, because you wouldn't think that you'd marry anybody if he didn't talk to you, or if you didn't talk to him, or if you didn't have any communication. Is that something that usually comes?
I don't know, we have the group here. Anybody want to comment on that?
Sometimes it seems like before you marry, it's easier, I don't know why, to communicate some of those thoughts and feelings. And after you're married, you kind of tend to drift away and just keep on surface things.
A lot of people don't want a relationship develop enough to really communicate. I don't know if they just pop right in.
They're
too busy doing things together to stop and
just
talk and share thoughts and feelings.
What often happens is during the courtship period, each one is working so hard to impress the other that you start chattering away, and you work and work and you work to impress the other person. And then when marriage comes, you say, it's not working yet. And I've seen this with a number of students that we see going through campus, where they really, really spend all sorts of energy trying to impress the other person, to get to know the other person. And we say before they're married, you know, if you work half as hard at keeping your marriage together as you have worked to get each other, you'll have a good marriage. But just don't give up. I mean, it's not once the knot is tied, then you can sit back and say everything's going to come along all by itself, because it doesn't. So that's often why the conversation stops afterward. You think, well, it should be there. We're married now, after all. But you still have to share yourself, and you still have to take some risk of saying what you feel.
I think that's the thing, too, is that I think sometimes we're afraid. I think especially in the church, I mean, we grow up with the idea that a Christian marriage, you know, you're not, you know, Christians don't fight and argue. And I think we begin to think, well, I'm not Christian if I feel this way. I think that's where this whole thing of grace comes in, that if in our relationship we should be willing to run that risk of sharing some of these things without being afraid that our mate is going to say, well, if that's the way you are, you know, forget it. I think this is part of that whole risk thing that goes with it.
Well, in taking the risk, and as you were saying about impressing one another, is it a reasonable question to ask when all of a sudden the doubts and uncertainties you may have had about each other before you were married cleared themselves and you decided that you were meant for one for the other?
Is that a question?
Yeah.
Well, I don't understand the question. It sounded like a statement.
When did it finally become clear to you that you two should be married? Was there one concrete experience, or was it just the whole chain of...
Well, I knew it long before he did.
Wasn't too long. Yeah, I really knew it too, but I was just too shy and scared to let him know. I think that in our situation, I don't know, we're no examples for the world, but I think our relationship really began in friendship. We were on the debate team at St. Olaf together. We've often said we only had one debate and one argument in all those years, just take out time for rebuttals and stuff, recess in between those times. But and we think it is extremely important that married couples be good friends. And we recommend in our little book, Ann Landers' advice, marry a good friend. And I think that if we are already married, to do the kind of thing Kathy's talking about there, to continue some of the things you do in courtship, to keep the friendship alive. Friendship isn't automatic either. So I don't know, in terms of any time or whatnot, they're just things that happen, and someday, you know, the idea gets in your head, I'm going to ask that girl to marry me. That's what I'm going to do. I don't know if, I think that one of the things that Carol Hinderly comments on in terms of the Beauvais book, he says one thing he disagrees with Beauvais on, and I agree with Carol Hinderly on that if you're not sure, don't get married. Well, I think in this life that we have doubts and uncertainties about all kinds of things. And I suppose, again, we can go off the road on either side that some people are so starry-eyed, they don't take time to ask some serious questions about what this relationship's going to be, and other people, on the other hand, are so, you know, just preoccupied with thinking of every possible problem they may have and every difficulty they're going to encounter, they couldn't possibly find anybody they could marry. So, some balance again there. Somebody else had a hand over here someplace. Yes.
Well, I think what you're saying, particularly in the Christian context, has been a real affirmation to me, as far as, it's what I've always felt about a husband and wife working together and having the three candles burning rather than just the one. I had the misfortune of attending a kind of week-long seminar thing where under the sponsorship, the guy said he was a Christian, he was teaching Christian ideals, and what he teaches was husband gets the authority from God.
Oh, yeah.
God gets the authority, wife gets the authority from husband and the children down the line, and then he drew this incredible graph that shows a cloud with a hand coming out of it and a hammer, and that's God. And this hammer,
the basic youth conflicts?
Absolutely. This hammer is hitting on a chisel. The chisel is the husband. And the chisel is hitting on this sweet little diamond in the rough. Why she feels this caused real conflict in my life that laid a real heavy burden of guilt on me, because I am an independent person, and I was just screaming out, what about me? I don't want to be a diamond in the rough. I want to be a chisel too.
Power to you. Maybe there are some others. There are many people. We have some in our parish who have been to Basic Youth Conflict. That's Bill Gothard and company. Speak very gratefully of that. We chuckle a bit about it. Some of you may be offended by that. If you'd like to comment on that, I've never been to it. Yes.
I've been to it, and I think Parkfoot Revival to me in Park also produced guilt. I think I misunderstood. Did you say that the husband was part of the chiseling process?
The husband was the chisel, and the wife is the diamond in the rough.
Mm-hmm. I guess I figured that God was the chisel, and
God had the hammer in his hand. No, the hammer was Jesus. God used the hammer was Jesus.
Yeah. I thought involved the Bible to me in thinking that God can use different people in my life to help me to become more like himself. And I experienced that, in a lot of ways. Different people they brought into my life that my personality did not maybe kind of coincide with, and yet I learned to deal with those people until I could learn to deal with that particular personality. It seemed like that same sort of person kept coming up to me, like maybe rubbed in the wrong way.
We are not very enthusiastic about that hierarchy thing. Larry Christensen and the Christian Family. Larry is a wonderful guy, and I've known him for many, many years, and we have all of us a lot to learn from him. But he has that same kind of setup of the authority line. It's the father, mother, children, and we certainly, as parents, husband and wife, we think we are first of all not just one of these roles. In God's presence, we're not just husband and wife or parents. We are persons before God, persons to each other, and as husband and wife, we yield together, we pray together in openness to God for his guidance. We seek that guidance together and not just have that hierarchy. And if Carol is better informed or she's more intelligent than I am in terms of decision-making on certain areas, I certainly hope that I've got at least enough brains to recognize that. And I hope if I have some insight on some things or understanding that in some ways would lead to a better decision somewhere else than she does, I hope she would. And we seek, I mentioned, what's right, and not just think about, it's my decision, I'm right, I'm doing this. Yes?
Do you think that the background and experience of the marriage partners sometimes makes the heavier burden of responsibility for decisions fall on one and not the other? Sometimes you kind of think of an ideal relationship where it's just 50-50, but don't you think it's just as satisfactory a marriage if it's 60-40 or 70-30 one way or the other?
I wouldn't want to. I don't like to.
Better that way?
I think it might work out. Sometimes, I suppose, when you talk about, 60-40 or whatever, that I would hope that in some situations that in the sharing of it, that sometimes you would make the decisions. I mean, there might be some areas that you would certainly, by your expertise and everything, those would be things that you would decide. But I think in the areas of conflict, where there would be a real conflict, I mean, there are a lot of things I let him decide I don't even care about. But when there are things that we are going to decide, like whether we're going to come to Holden Village or if we're going to go to see my mother or something like that, then that's something we have to work out. And I would no way just let him say, no kidding, we're not doing that. I mean, I just could not live with that situation. And I think then that's the time when you have to sit down and you have to problem solve. You have to look at it and weigh all the different things that go into it. And at that time, I don't think you can just say, well, this is something for me to say, well, it's my mother and I'm going and you can stay home if you don't like it. I mean, that would be wrong too.
There may be times when you might want to do that.
I mean, that might. But I mean, I think I would hope that, it would work out. You can't just say it's going to be 50-50. It may well work out that most of the time he might make certain, the decisions if you could tabulate them. But I would hope that it's always a shared responsibility.
We stress, too, and I'll get to your question in one second, that there certainly are many, many times when we it's just plain common sense to yield to the other person even if we don't think it's correct. I mean, there are all kinds of things. Suppose Carol's had a bad day and all this kind of stuff, And she says, I'm not fixing supper. Let's go out for supper together. I think, well, that's a dumb thing to do. I mean, why would we do that for? You got all the stuff in the refrigerator. Well, if I got any antenna working at all, I say, well, okay, let's, where should we go? Let's, there's a Perkins Pancake House, and there's the Rustler, and we can, you know, I mean, and the same thing the other way, too, that, you had a hand up, excuse me.
Well, is it a case that we're examples for our children as well as our father and mother were examples for us? And I'm thinking about my own father, and possibly yours was the same. He was the boss in our family, and my mother was not the mother, she was the woman. Now, today, if I would call my wife the woman, I've had it. my dad was a farmer, worked on a farm, worked hard all his life, up in North Dakota, where he mentioned many, many times their saw house and this and that.
My dad was born in a log cabin. We can compare notes later.
my dad was the man of the house according to the Bible, and my mother was the woman. And consequently, he made the decisions. Now, I admire my father, and in many, many ways, he's been an example. But don't you think a lot of that has been handed down? I don't know, maybe your father was different. But most of the...
Well, I never heard my father ever call my mother the woman. That.
No, in making the decisions.
He was, Prince. I think, as I mentioned, that in our family, I think Dad was pretty much the head of the house, and my mother was the heart of the house. He was rather stern and, you know, concerned to make the decision. She was an exceedingly warm and, you know, gracious person, as is Carol. I'm not trying to make comparisons. Yes?
To refer back to this matter of submission, in the scripture, the verse that says, wives be in submission to your husband, et cetera, goes on that whole passage, talks about
Ephesians 5.
Then talks about husbands, then talks about children, and it talks about the slaves. In other words, all these various relationships. But hardly anybody ever stops to remember that the verse in front of all that section, that all that section is explaining, is the verse, be in submission to one another out of reverence for Christ.
That's very, I'm grateful that you bring that up, because on the whole matter we could have a long discussion about the biblical references in this regard, and I think it's significant that you put together, for example, the fact that in Ephesians 5 you have the statements about the husband as the head of the wife. Going on later into Ephesians 6, it talks about slaves being obedient to your masters and so on. Now, I don't know of anybody today, maybe there are some, who would take that Ephesians 6 passage as a statement that is of eternal truth for all time. They say it advocates, it approves slavery, and that the slaves are to be obedient to their masters, and slavery is all right. We say, oh, no, can't do that. But yet there are people who would take the passage in Ephesians 5 beyond the opening section you quote and say, well, that just proves that the husband is to make all the decisions and the wife is to be silent.
I think the passage in Ephesians 5 that talks about the husband is explaining how a husband is going to be submissive
to each other, right. It's interesting, too, that in that I think the biblical witness reflects both the customs of the time as well as the gospel of Christ. And the same Apostle Paul, who can make those statements, can make the statements in Galatians 3:27-28, I believe it is, that in Christ there is neither male nor female. You are one in Christ.
It's also important to remember that verse, be submissive to one another, is talking to spirit-filled persons, because in Ephesians 5:18 it says, be filled with the Spirit. And then he goes on to say all the things that will happen then, and he goes on with this admonition, be submissive to one another. And so you can't even take it out of context
say
that the whole world ought to be doing this, or even a Christian who doesn't understand that the Spirit wants to live through him and fill him and
all of this we need to keep in the context of grace. All of our living, breathing, marrying, whatever it is. Any other comments or reactions? Yes.
This doesn't have a biblical reference, but the only thing I remember from my reading in to ensure that I would have a happy marriage and I would be a good wife was, is that one of the most important things in a marriage was a sense of humor, and that you not take yourself too seriously, or even the criticism.
Very important. That doesn't mean to laugh at each other.
Remember that, no. But I do use my sense of humor.
So right, I think that's, if we can take things a little more lightly, that's not the same as being sarcastic or, you know, making fun of each other. Putting, that can be very bad, very destructive thing, but to laugh at ourselves first and laugh at each other. We encourage couples on the honeymoon to have take a little sense of humor along in the suitcase on that one, too. Honeymoons and marriages, I suppose, are one of the most overladen kind of institutions in all society, overladen with all these expectations. That was another hand. Yes?
I'd like to emphasize what you said before about praying together. That certainly, not only through all the problems that might come up in a marriage, but the joys, and if you can pray together, and I don't mean just as a family, even, but just the two of you, of us regularly, that brings such a feeling of grace and joy into the marriage.
I think that the sharing of that whole dimension of life in grace, we could have long discussion about mixed marriages and all of that. We had a mixed marriage for about 5 years. I was ALC and Carol was LCA. But we still managed occasionally to pray together during that period. I think even even in terms of prayer and that whole area of devotional life, it doesn't always have to be so formal. It can be as you've got your heads together on the pillow, you can have a little
right.
prayer. And
I think that's the best.
You know that.
The way my husband and I do prayer, that works out neat for us. We like the morning time best. We'll go for a walk, and we'll be walking with our eyes open. Someone may really wonder what we're doing, but we're addressing God as we're talking, and we'll just tell Him what we're just talking to Him as we're walking. A neat way to pray again.
Beautiful. Peripatetic praying.
What?
Isn't that what it is? Isn't peripatetic walking? Is that walking? Am I wrong word? I use a bad word?
Nobody knows whether you're right.
I think one thing when you talk about praying together and some of these other things, I think that goes kind of back to expectations too. Maybe I had all the wrong expectations when I think about getting married, but I think we have images of what a Christian home is, and it's been a great source for me. It's lucky I live with such a gracious man, because I was worried when our children were little if we didn't always get the family devotions in at supper time, and you know, supper time is the worst time sometimes, especially when people know that that's when he's home and the phone is ringing. And here I was thinking, I'm failing as a Christian mother because my kids aren't praying at supper time with their father who's on the telephone, you know. And I think sometimes the burdens that we carry are things that are, you know, the ideas that we've had either from our own home or from things that we've read about what is the ideal marriage, whether it's your prayer life, whether it's your life with your children or whatever. And I think sometimes we have to be, not that we don't have great hopes, but that we should be, realistic and a little bit easy, like you said, to be able to laugh about it. We got so that we laughed about family devotions in our house because it got to be, you know, just almost impossible. And I thought,
your kids are different ages, as some of you know, and you've got all kinds of, oh my land. I think that example of walking together, that's a great example. It's just a real reminder that it doesn't always have to be in some rigid,
like
here's the family altar and everybody's sitting around and Dad has the big Bible. I was not brought up in that kind of a situation, and our family on the farm, and Carol wasn't. Carol's a PK. She's a plumber's kid.
And plumbers weren't home too much at supper time either sometimes.
Again, it's a whole atmosphere. Maybe we should end on that note. It's about time for a bell to ring or get to Vespers here, but... again, if we can look together to Jesus Christ and live in those promises of grace and marriage in those days, there are going to be plenty of terrible days, but there can be a good number of wonderful days too. And we're very grateful for the gifts of the life we have been able to share together, and hope all of you and that grace can be good to each other and know that same joy in full measure. Thank you very much.